there. Please follow along. I would like to take up the subject. It's called the Korban Pesach, which means the Passover sacrifice. And we'll go through some of the verses in the text, and I'd like to analyze it. It's chapter 12 in the book of Exodus. This takes place when the Jews are in Egypt, and we'll go through the text just quickly, just to get the basic ideas. Then I'd like to pose the problems that I'd like to deal with. And this is chapter 12, verse 1. And God said to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, this month shall be for you, that's the month of Nisan, the first of the month, according to the months of the year. Speak to the congregation of Israel and say to them that on the 10th of this month, they shall take for them, each man shall take a sheep for the families and for the households. That sheep is to be set aside for the Passover sacrifice. And if there were not enough people in one household to eat the entire sheep, then they could join together with their neighbors, other families, and appoint. Each person had to be designated. In other words, a person couldn't just partake of the Passover sacrifice unless he had been designated according to a group. It had to be eaten in a group, and each person had to designate himself in advance. Then it says that you shall take a whole sheep that is without blemish, a year old, and it shall be from the sheep or from the goats. And this shall be, I'm on verse 6 now, this shall be something which you shall guard. This was a specific requirement. That is to say that they were supposed to take it on the 10th of the month, to set it aside on the 10th of the month, and to guard it until the 14th day of that month. And the entire congregation of Israel shall slaughter it in the afternoon. So the sacrifice, the Passover sacrifice, was slaughtered on the 14th, but it had to be taken, set aside, and guarded from the 10th on. And you shall take from the blood and place it, actually they sprinkled it on the doorposts and on the beam above the doorposts, on the houses that it was to be eaten in. And you shall eat the meat on that night, roasted. The meat had to be roasted together with bitter herbs and matzah, unleavened bread. You shall not eat from it raw, couldn't be eaten raw, nor cooked in any kind of liquid, literally water, but any kind of liquid, but only roasted. It had to be roasted whole, the head together with the legs and the innards. It couldn't be cut up and roasted. It had to be roasted whole. And you shall not leave anything over until the morning, and anything which is left over until the morning has to be burnt in fire. And this is very important, verse 11. And thus shall you eat it, your loins girded, your shoes on your feet, and your staffs in your hand. Now Rashi explains that what this really means basically is that prepared for travel. They were, if it was in our situation, with our coats on, our hats on, and they used to walk with staffs. So a person had to eat it in that state as though he was prepared for the road. And you shall eat it in a hurry, not in a calm, leisurely way. It had to be eaten in a hurry. For this is the Hebrew is Pesach, and it's translated as the Passover. It is a Passover unto God. All right, then it proceeds, and I will pass over throughout the land of Egypt that night, and I'll smite every firstborn. This is the evening of the tenth plague, from man to animal. And in all of the gods of Egypt, I will execute judgments. I am the Lord. And the blood will be a sign on the houses that you are there, and I'll see the blood, and I'll skip over again, Pasachti, that's where the word Pesach comes from. I'll try and elucidate why the holiday is known by the name of Pesach, or Passover, why that's such a significant element in the story. And there will not be any plague to destroy you when I smite Egypt. All right, and so on and so forth. I want to concentrate on the basic idea of the Korban Pesach, that's the Passover sacrifice. And I'd like to pose a number of questions. If anybody has any other questions, I'd be happy to deal with them. But I'd like to pose what I consider to be the pertinent questions pertaining to it. And I'd like to start off with a very basic question. see that the Passover sacrifice is one of the 613 commandments. Once the Torah was given, this was a commandment which was applicable to the Jews. Of course, it required certain conditions, like any other sacrifice. There were many sacrifices in the Torah amongst the 613 commandments, and they're applicable only when we have the Beis HaMikdash, we have the temple. So therefore, it's not applicable in our time. And when the base of the temple is rebuilt, so this mitzvah will be obligatory again. Now, my question is like this. If this is one of the 613 commandments, all the commandments were basically given at Sinai. And this event occurs prior to Sinai. This is the Exodus. So why is this mitzvah, this commandment of the Passover sacrifice, why is it so important that the Jews had to be commanded in it prior to the actual giving of the Torah? Why were they given this mitzvah to perform prior to the Exodus? There must be something extremely significant about this mitzvah, and it must be related to the whole idea of the Exodus. I think it will shed some light on the idea of the Exodus, but I think it's a question. I mean, there's many. If God wanted to give them a mitzvah before he gave them the whole Torah, why this particular mitzvah? What does it have to do with the theme of the Exodus? Not only were they given this mitzvah, but as we see, their very survival from the 10th plague was dependent upon performing this mitzvah. Only those people who performed the mitzvah, as it says, I will see the blood, which Rashi translates to mean God doesn't have to see the blood, obviously. The blood means that I'll see that you're involved in the mitzvah and skip over you. So the performance of the mitzvah was a requirement for redemption. If a person didn't perform the mitzvah, he wasn't worthy of being redeemed. So that's basically my first question. I'd like to raise some other questions with regard to this, because, as I said, the Passover was performed in Egypt, but then once the Torah was given, it's a permanent mitzvah. That's called Pesach Doros, Pesach, the Passover for the generations. Now, it's interesting to note that in some respects, the permanent Passover, that is the one that we were to observe after we received the Torah, is similar to the one of Egypt. In other words, the question that I'm raising is, was it the same performance, the same mitzvah, or were there differences between the two? Was the performance of the mitzvah of the Passover in Egypt different than the way it was to be performed in the permanent mitzvah? Now, it's very interesting. Ramban, Nachmanides, points out that in some respects it was similar, and in some respects it was different. How so? The verse which describes how the meat was to be prepared, that is to say, that it couldn't be cooked in any liquid, it had to be roasted, and it had to be roasted whole, and so forth. In other words, he says all the laws that pertain to the substance of the sacrifice was the same in Egypt and for the generations. There was no difference. But the verse that I mentioned before, to pay attention to, verse 11, thus shalt you eat it, with your loins girded, and your shoes on your feet, and your staffs in your hands, and to eat it in a hurried fashion, everything we would refer to as the manner of the performance, the way they performed the act of eating, that was unique to Egypt. That took place, was applicable only in the Passover of Egypt, but was not applicable in the permanent Passover. That is to say, that after the Jews came to Israel and we had the temple and they brought the Passover sacrifice, so the preparation of the meat had to be done the same way as in Egypt. But they didn't have to wear their coats and their shoes and their staffs, and they didn't have to eat in a hurry. They ate in a leisurely kind of way. So I'd like to understand, what is the reason for that? Why were these commands to eat the Passover in this particular way? Why? Well, what's the reason behind it? What's the connection with the whole theme of the Passover in Egypt? Now, of course, it's tempting to say that they had to do this for a practical reason, because they were about to leave Egypt. But that's not the case, because they ate the sacrifice the night before. Then that entire night they stayed indoors and they didn't leave until the morning. So it's not an issue of practicality, that simply they had to be ready to leave because God was going to take them out immediately after they finished eating. That wasn't the case. Moreover, if that was the case, that's practicality. and that wouldn't be incorporated as part of the mitzvah. Of course, if the Jews had to leave immediately, then God didn't have to command them to put on their coats or to put on their shoes. So this wasn't because of practicality. This had to do with something in the philosophy of the mitzvah and in the entire reason for the commandment in Egypt. Okay, so those are the questions that I'm posing for myself to try and answer. It's interesting to note that there were some other, you may have noted some other differences between the Passover in Egypt and subsequent Passovers. I mentioned the most significant one, which Nachmanides points out, the manner of eating. But there are some other differences. For example, the obligation to sprinkle the blood on the doorpost, that, of course, did not take place in subsequent years. That was only in Egypt. And that is because that has to do with the idea of the 10th plague. That was tied in with that concept, with the Jews being saved from the 10th plague. So that was a difference. But I'm not really, at the moment tonight, I don't think I'm going to take up the whole reason why they had to sprinkle the blood on the doorpost. I'm just pointing out that that was another difference. There is another command, another aspect of the mitzvah, which was unique to Egypt. Rashi points it out. And this is the basic theme of this chapter. The command to Moses and Aaron to take the sheep on the 10th of the month. That was a mitzvah. It wasn't just a suggestion that they, because really the mitzvah was to have a sheep on the 14th. So if that's the case, I mean, a person, if he wants to, he can prepare early. If he doesn't want to, like we have to have matzah, the Passover is coming up, so some people are very meticulous, so they've already arranged, they've purchased their matzah. Some people wait to the last minute. The truth of the matter is, it doesn't make any difference. As long as you have matzah on the first night of Passover, you fulfill the mitzvah. But here they were commanded to actually set it aside on the 10th. They weren't permitted to wait any later than that. That was a mitzvah. And that Rashi points out also that that was only in Egypt. In subsequent years, they did not have to set aside the sheep on the 10th. They could have set aside a sheep earlier than that, or they could have set aside a sheep later than that. There was no specific mitzvah, as long as they had the sheep for the 14th. Now, I'd like to begin the explanation, the elucidation of these issues with Rashi. I'm going to be relying on the commentary of Rashi primarily with regard to these problems. Now, what exactly was the mitzvah of setting it aside? Was it simply to take a sheep and to designate it for the 14th? Yes, that was part of it, but there was another element over here. And if you take a look at verse 6, it says, it shall be something which is guarded until the 14th. So it wasn't just a matter of setting it aside on the 10th, but they had to guard it from the 10th until the 14th, which was the time that they slaughtered it. And what does it mean to guard it? What does that entail? What do you mean guard it? Do they have to stand watch over it? I'm going to turn to Rashi now. And in Rashi's elucidation of this verse, he brings down his explanation of the entire significance, the entire reason behind the Passover in Egypt. All right, so Rashi on verse 6 says, Mishmeres, that's the Hebrew term for guarding something, something which is guarded. So Rashi says, this is an expression of examination. It requires examination for blemish for 4 days before the slaughtering. So that's what it means, it shall be guarded. It is to say that you have to be examining it during the course of those, from the 10th day and on, to make sure that it hasn't become disqualified. Because in sacrifice, it said it has to be an animal without blemishes. And there's many, many types of physical blemish, not just physical blemish, other types of blemishes that could disqualify the animal from being utilized as a sacrifice. Now, Rashi asks, why did God, in this instance, precede the taking to the slaughtering 4 days, which God did not command in the permanent Passover for the generations? Now he quotes one of the rabbis of the Talmud, who elucidates this on the basis of the famous verse in Ezekiel, chapter 15. So he says that Rabbi Masya ben Cheresh explained. It says in Ezekiel that the God, speaking about the birth of the Jewish nation, I passed over you. God says, I passed over you and I saw you. And behold, your time was a time of love. It's referring, of course, to the time of the Exodus. The time had come to fulfill the promise that I had promised to Abraham, that I would redeem his children. And they didn't have any mitzvot in their hands to be involved with in order that they could be redeemed. As it says, and you were naked and bare. Ezekiel says, I saw you and you were naked and bare. And Reb Masya is interpreting this nakedness to mean naked from mitzvot. You didn't have commandments to be involved in. So that was holding up the redemption. And he gave, Reb Masya continues, so God gave them two mitzvot. The blood, both of them entail blood. The blood of the Pesach and the blood of Milah, of circumcision. They circumcised on that night. As it says, that you were steeped in your bloods, plural. That is to say, with two bloods. The blood of the Passover and the blood of circumcision. And then he quotes another verse to support, because the text itself only speaks about one mitzvah. It speaks about the mitzvah of the Passover. It doesn't mention anything about circumcision. But from the words of the prophet, we see that they were involved in circumcision as well. Of course, the mitzvah of circumcision had been given earlier, but apparently they hadn't been scrupulous in performing it. So they rectified that on the night of a Passover in Egypt. And he quotes another verse from Zechariah, who says, also you, in the dom of your covenant, did I send you forth. I sent forth your prisoners from a pit in which there was no water. It's a reference to Egypt. And then he says, moreover, you were steeped in idols and idolatry. So God said to them, pull, this is the verse later on in Exodus, pull and take unto you. That's the way the Torah expresses it. Pull your, now he interprets it, here's the interpretation. That is to say, what does it mean, pull and take unto you a sheep for the Passover? That means, pull your hands away from your idols and take unto you a sheep of mitzvah. So, that is the explanation. This would explain a lot of things. This would answer my question as to why the Jews needed this mitzvah in Egypt. Why this mitzvah was given prior to the body of the 613 mitzvahs. What he's saying basically is that the time had come. God had promised that promise was made to Abraham, that your children will be strangers in a land which is not theirs, and they'll be oppressed and so forth, but then I'll redeem them. So God promised the redemption. Now the time for the redemption had come. Everything was ready. But God took a look at them, and they were bare. They were naked and bare, which means that they didn't have mitzvot. And they did not merit redemption without the mitzvot. So they had to have mitzvot, commandments. So God gave them the commandment of the Pesach, of the Passover. And from the prophets we see that it wasn't just that, but there was also the mitzvah of Milah, of circumcision. That wasn't given to them at that point, but it was given before, but they had to perform that mitzvah. So that's what Rashi means, apparently. That would explain why they had the additional requirement of setting it aside on the 10th, which was not a permanent feature. It all has to do with the theme of mitzvot. Seems to be adding to the number of mitzvot that they had to perform. But the basic theme of this Rashi is that the Jews were given the Passover sacrifice in Egypt because the time had come, and they were lacking something. They were lacking mitzvot, and for some reason or other, they could not be redeemed without mitzvot. Okay. Now, I believe that Rashi's explanation over here is in contradiction, at least on the surface, would seem to contradict something which Rashi says in a different place. So if you have a Chumash there, let's turn now to chapter 3 in Exodus. And this is the encounter between Moses and God at the burning bush, the dialogue. And Moses, after God had spoken to Moses and told him what he wanted him to do, to be the one who would go to Pharaoh and to take out the Jews from Egypt. Now we have, this is in chapter 3, verse 11. These two verses are very important. What was Moses' response? And Moses said to God, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and that I should take the children of Israel from Egypt?" All right? Now Rashi interprets this to mean that Moshe was asking two questions over here. The first question, according to Rashi, is, "Who am I?" He was just asking a question about himself. Of course, Moses was the most humble of all men, and he didn't understand what qualifications he had to be the leader of the Jews. So that's, "Who am I? I'm nobody. I have no qualifications to be the leader to undertake such a mission." That was his first one. But the other one, "And that I should take the children of Israel from Egypt," so Rashi interprets this to mean a different question. That is to say, he's saying, and even if I should be qualified, what merit do the Jews have to warrant your intervention and redemption? So Moses was asking a question over here that pertained to the Jews. I don't understand. Why did they merit being redeemed from Egypt? Now, if you take a look now, God answers. From God's answer, the way Rashi interprets it, it's clear that Moses was asking two questions. And God said, "For I will be with you. And this is the sign that I have sent you. When you take out the nation from Egypt, they will worship the Lord on this mountain." Of course, that's the mount that they were speaking on, Mount Sinai. And the worship of the Lord is a reference to the receiving of the Torah. Now, Rashi has a very interesting way of interpreting verse 12. I'm going to quote or paraphrase the Rashi. So Rashi in this verse says that God answered Moses on the first question first and on the second question a second. And he said, "Concerning that which you said, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh?" So God says, "This is not from you, but from me, for I will be with you." That is to say, my understanding of that is that Moses assumed that God was giving him responsibility to fulfill the mission. That is to say that he was commanded to go to Pharaoh and undertake the leadership, and he was responsible to see it through. If that is the case, Moses said, "I just don't have the ability. I'm not a statesman. I'm not a leader." And God's answer was, "No, that's not the way it's done. I will be with you," meaning that I am the one that's going to be the ultimate cause of their redemption, but you're just going to act as my instrument. So therefore, you don't have to have any qualifications because I'm not placing responsibility for bringing about the result in your hands. That's my hands. You're just my instrument. Now, concerning the second question, and this vision that you've seen in the bush is a sign for you that I have sent you and that you will succeed in my mission and that I have the power to save you. Just as you see, this bush is fulfilling my command, and it's not being consumed, so too, you will go in my mission, and you won't be harmed. It's a very interesting idea, just tangentially. This wasn't my theme, but it's interesting because the question one of my students asked recently, if you read the story, it's very hard to understand the fact that Moses was able to go to Pharaoh continuously and to negotiate with him and make demands and so forth, and then Pharaoh didn't do anything to harm him. It's almost impossible to imagine. Pharaoh had total power. He oppressed the Jews. And in fact, the first time around, Moshe had to flee the land because he had killed an Egyptian. The Egyptian that that the Egyptian who was beating up on the Jew, and Moshe intervened and he killed him. And when Pharaoh found out about it, so Moshe had to leave because he would have killed him. And it's almost impossible to imagine that here was Moshe had come back and he was leading the Jews in disobedience against Pharaoh. He was a threat and so forth. Why didn't the Pharaoh just eliminate him? Why didn't he just kill him? In fact, there's no mention in the text that Pharaoh even thought about it or tried to kill him. And the only answer I could come up with was that this was divine providence. And that's what Dvei Rashi explains it over here, that we don't know. God doesn't describe for us how God brought this about, but the fact that Moshe would be protected and that the Egyptians would not harm him is symbolized in the burning bush. It's something which goes against the laws of nature. According to the laws of nature, the bush should have been burnt by the fire, and God's indicating to him that according to the laws of nature, you would have been destroyed. In any political situation, any person who was going against the authority, you know, he's got to watch out for his life. The authority is going to try and destroy him. But this didn't happen to Moshe. All right, just a tangential point. Now, to the second idea, God says, concerning that which you asked, what merit does Israel have that they should leave Egypt? So the answer is, I have a great thing here concerning this Exodus. For they are destined to receive the Torah on this mountain at the end of 3 months after they leave Egypt. So then, if that's the case, Moshe asked God, what merit do the Jews have to warrant this? And God answered. What was the answer? The answer was that the truth of the matter is that in terms of the situation as it is now, they don't merit it. They don't have any particular merit, but the merit is in the future. They're designated to receive the Torah. And the fact is that since they are the people who were designated for this, and they're going to receive the Torah, so it'll be a merit, so to speak, retroactively. And that's the answer. Apparently Moses thought that there has to be some quality which the people possess at this point in order to warrant redemption. Obviously, Moshe held that the mere fact that the Jews are being oppressed, and of course Moshe believed that their oppression was an injustice. You have to say that because Moses fought against their oppression. He slew the Egyptian. So Moses clearly held that the oppression was an injustice. But if that's the case, then why is he as God? Why wasn't he content? Of course God should intervene. It's unjust. The Jews are being unjustly oppressed. Why is Moses even questioning it? Because the answer is because it's one thing for Moses. Moses is a human being. He has an obligation to fight for the truth. He has an obligation to protect the weak, to fight for justice. That's part of the perfection of Moses. But God as a creator does not necessarily intervene in every situation where a people is being oppressed. That's something which is left to man, must exercise his free will and act accordingly and intervene in a situation. But God is not under any obligation to intervene in every situation. God sometimes does. But when God does so, God's acting in accordance with the laws of God's providence. So apparently, that's what Moses was asking about. You don't intervene in every situation when people are being oppressed. Apparently, it has to be people that merit your intervention. So if that's the case, his question is, the Jews, as far as Moses could see, they didn't merit it. And God is saying, you're right, they don't. But in the future, they'll receive the Torah. And that's the merit. Now, it seems to me that the answer that Rashi mentions over here is in contradiction with the, if we can go back a few steps, with the explanation that he quoted for the reason for the Passover, for the mitzvah of the Passover in Egypt. Why? Because, as Rav Masya explained, why were they given the commandment? Because the time had come for their redemption, and they didn't have mitzvos to be worthy of redemption, in order to merit redemption. Oh, so this presupposes that they require mitzvos in order to be redeemed. But that contradicts what Rashi said in the other place. The other place says they don't require anything to be redeemed. They're going to be redeemed for the sake of receiving mitzvahs later on. So which one of both of these things can't be true? First of all, of the explanation of Rav Masya itself is a little bit difficult. Because the purpose of the Exodus was to bring them to Mount Sinai to give them the mitzvot. If that's the purpose of the Exodus, so then why do you have to have mitzvot in order to warrant getting mitzvot? You're being taken out to get the mitzvot. But, as we saw in the other, in the first Rashi, God said that I'm taking them out, not because of any merit they have now, but because they're going to receive the Torah. So, why didn't, according to Rav Masya, why didn't God say that they merit it because they're going to perform the Passover? They're going to perform the mitzvah of Passover in Egypt, and that's the merit. Obviously, that's not the merit. So, if that's the case, I'd like to resolve these two conflicting explanations. Now, in order to resolve this, I think that the term merit is being used in two different senses in these two different explanations that we've seen. One sense of the term to merit something means to deserve it. And that is the sense in which Moses asked God. When Moses asked God, what do the Jews merit? He was asking, why do they deserve your intervention? That's as I explained before, that God doesn't intervene for every people. They have to be deserving of it. And as far as the ultimate reason as to why they deserve to be redeemed, the answer is, it doesn't lie in any particular achievement, any particular quality that they have. It's really not because of anything they've done, but rather it's because they have been designated to receive the Torah. It's only because of the Torah, and it's not because of anything they've done. That's the reason why they deserve my intervention. Okay, but there's another sense in the term merit. And that is, let me give an illustration, if I might. For example, Maimonides explains, when we set up a Jewish government, we had the kingship. So the king is appointed. The first king is appointed. Has to be appointed by a Sanhedrin, and together with a prophet. Now, the way the kingship works, it works to a dynastic principle. It's a father to son, father to son. So, the second king, the third king, why does he deserve to be the king? It's nothing that he himself has done, but it's only because he's the son of the father. That's the way the system works. But, let's say the king dies and he leaves over a son. The fact that he deserves to be the king because of designation, because of the dynastic principle, is not sufficient. There's another sense. He has to be qualified. He has to have the capability. And Maimonides explains that he has to measure up to his father in two respects, in terms of fear of God and in terms of wisdom. And if he doesn't have these qualities, he can't be the king, because he can't relate to the kingship. He can't assume that position. Now that, I believe, is the sense of the question of Rav Masya. That is to say, that even though the Jews are deserving of being redeemed because they're going to receive the Torah, that is still not enough. That's still not enough. There's another issue that's involved. And what is the issue over here? It means like this. See, Ezekiel passed by, and he said that God had passed by, and he said that the time had come. It was a time of love. What does it mean? It means that the basic conditions for the Exodus had been fulfilled. Now, we know that the experience of enslavement in Egypt was necessary. God promised this to Abraham, that the Jews would go through this experience of being oppressed, of being slaves in Egypt. Now, this was essential. It was essential for basically two reasons. Because a tremendous transformation occurred. When they came down, they were basically a small family unit, a small group. And it was God's will that they should develop into a nation. So So they went through a period of, they went through a process of transformation, and they became powerful. They expanded numerically, and they developed all of the elements of nationhood. That's what it means. He saw that they were formed, that they were well formed. They had all of the physical qualities of being a nation. But everything was prepared. The experience of enslavement was necessary for another reason as well. And that is, I would say, for a spiritual reason. Because there's a famous statement of the rabbis that God went to the various nations and offered them the Ten Commandments. And each nation asked for an illustration of what the commandments entail. So in one case they heard, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not kill, and so forth. And for one reason or other, they all rejected. Except God came to the Jews, and the Jews said, we will do and we will hear. Unconditional acceptance. But I think the meaning is, I don't think you have to take this in a literal sense, I think the idea is, the rabbis are trying to explain why the Jews were different than other peoples, what rendered them, what made them prepared to accept the system. Because on the surface, it's a system of commandments, and most people will view it as interfering with their basic freedom. Mitzvot, commandments, they look at them as being restrictions. Until you study them, until you understand their tremendous benefit and the tremendous knowledge and how this is really in line with your nature, because most people believe that their nature is be instinctual beings and have instinctual physical and emotional enjoyments, and anything that interferes with that, I can't eat certain foods, I can't engage in certain practices, I can't engage in certain sexual relations. People that are not familiar with the great philosophical content of the Torah are going to rebel against this. So why were the Jews different? What made them different? Now, I think to a certain extent the experience of enslavement was essential, because it's a known thing that when a person is in a situation where he's deprived from access to gratifying all of his materialistic fantasies, everything is taken away, and all of his physical desires and instinctual desires, we see this today, people in prison. They lead all kinds of crazy lives, following all their wild instincts, and finally when reality catches up with them and they're put into a situation where they have no access whatsoever to their physical gratification, so they're in a situation, well, though now they're willing to listen, maybe there's another value. If they come along, you try and explain to them that the real good in this life is not the physical, that's just a means to an end, but man has a soul and a spirit and an understanding, and to be involved in the pursuit of knowledge is really the greatest good. That's something they never would have listened to you. That never made a dent, as long as they were able to go about gratifying their desires. But once that's been taken away, and that's the Jews, when the Jews were in a situation, they were so downtrodden that they couldn't even maintain any physical, materialistic fantasies, then when Moses came to them and told them that there's going to be, that God has redeemed, is going to redeem them, there's going to be a new situation, but it's going to revolve around this concept of mitzvot, then they were in the proper frame of mind that they could listen. And that's what distinguished them, one of the factors which distinguished them from other peoples that had not gone through this experience. Now the thing is, so Egypt, the enslavement was necessary, but in my opinion, it was a double-edged sword. On the one hand, it was beneficial in the sense that it gave them the cohesion, they became a nation, and they obtained the physical characteristics of nationhood, and also with regard to the spiritual, it made them more predisposed to be willing to listen to the significance of spiritual values. But on the other hand, it posed a tremendous danger, because you're all familiar with the fact that the culture, Egypt, was a society which was steeped in primitive idolatry, superstition, idolatry, and that entire culture and lifestyle. And of course, the Jews were exposed to that for many, many years. And the rabbis say that God determined the exact moment when they had to be redeemed. Why did he do the exact moment? Because they had reached the lowest depths. They had reached the lowest depths of corruption, of spiritual corruption, and that had God waited any longer, they might have been on the point of being saved. So, it means that there was one problem. The Jews were being taken out of Egypt, as we've seen, not because of their own greatness, but because they were designated to receive the Torah. But now the question is, were they capable? Were they qualified to be able to relate to a system of Torah, to relate to a system of mitzvot? Or had they become so steeped in the primitive culture of Egypt that there was no way they could relate to a system of mitzvot? I believe that is what Rav Mashi is talking about. This was a test that was given to them. The test was to see whether they could pull themselves away from the primitive culture of Egypt and to relate to a system of mitzvot. Now you see something which is very, very interesting about the Torah. Because the mitzvah that they were given was the mitzvah to perform a sacrifice. It's interesting, Maimonides, in the Guide to the Perplexed, he speaks about sacrifices. He says that, ideally, that's his philosophy, not everybody agreed with him. Nachmanides, for example, didn't agree with him on this point. But he says that, ideally, the Torah really would have not included sacrifices. Because there are certain dangerous elements to sacrifices, because if it can be corrupted, if a person doesn't approach a sacrifice in the proper way, so then it can be harmful. Because the whole idea of sacrificing to God, you have to understand exactly what you're doing. I mean, people can't have any kind of a mistake to have the notion that somehow they're doing something for God, they're propitiating God. But he says the Torah included it, because the Torah understands that it's a very powerful emotional need in man. That's the way people were, societies were in those days, and every religion included sacrifices. So the very idea of establishing a religion which did not include sacrifices would have been impossible. And that's why the Torah did include it. But what the Torah did was to take the institution of sacrifices and to attach it to a system of true ideas. And that's the way the Torah really perfects an individual. The Torah is really a system of true ideas, abstract ideas, correct notions on how a person is to live his life and how a person is to relate to God. So that's why the essential involvement of a person who lives the Torah life is study of the Torah, understanding. It's through gaining of knowledge and understanding that a person perfects himself. But a person is not a thinker. He's not a lover of knowledge by nature. But people are all, they have powerful religious emotions. Now, what the Torah does is that it really appeals. The Torah doesn't demand that you give up all of your emotions and just become a thinker. Because on the ultimate level, a person is involved in thinking and thoughts and true ideas and in perceiving the wisdom of God. That's the greatest service of God. In fact, what did the Jews do on Mount Sinai? They were involved in Torah. They were listening to the Ten Commandments. That's the study of Torah. And how did God refer to it when he told to Moses, "They shall worship me on this mountain"? That's worship. They weren't praying, but what was the worship? They were involved in the study of Torah. But the point is, the greatness of the Torah is that it's a system which leads a person step by step. It deals with him on the level of his ordinary emotions, his religious emotions, and not just his religious emotions, but all of his natural, even the instinctual emotions, and it utilizes those emotions to bring him into a system which is based upon abstract ideas. Let's take, for example, even in prayer. A person has an emotional desire to pray to God. It's a natural thing. When a person is in distress, a person is sad, even when a person is happy, he wants to express himself to God. That's a natural emotion. Now, the Torah allows a person to pray, but it does not allow him to pray in accordance to the way his emotions would dictate. Prayer itself is something which has to be done with a structure. It has to be done at certain times. And the way you express yourself to God, there's many, many laws. In fact, the very words that we use, we can't make up our own prayers. A person makes up his own prayers, the rabbis say he could be guilty of blasphemy, because the things that he imagines to be in his own imagination that he's praising God could be the most ridiculous things. So we can only utilize those terms that have been endorsed by the rabbis who base themselves on the words of the prophets and in the words of the Torah, the words of Moses. Our prayers basically go back to Moses. And only those expressions that Moses used are we permitted to use. So why, emotionally speaking, I'm crying out to God? What difference does it make? The answer is that the Torah is allowing you to gratify your emotional need to pray to God, but only if you can do so through a system of concepts and true ideas. But if you're going to try and satisfy that emotion in the way that the emotion dictates, then that's the corruption of the soul, because you're just following your own emotions. And you can't relate to God according to what your own emotions dictate. You have to relate to God in accordance with the objective truth. So that was the crucial test that the Jews were given in Egypt. And this would determine whether they were worthy of being redeemed or not. Could they relate to a system of mitzvos? And that's the Korban Pesach. That's what, you see, what the second answer that, second reason actually that Rashi quotes, Mishchu Kuchu, as we said, to pull and take, pull the sheep. And Rav Moshe said, pull away, pull your hands away from your idols and take the sheep of mitzvah. It's almost saying that the sheep of mitzvah was a substitute for something else that you would like to take. You would like to engage in you want to bring a sacrifice to God. But you've got to remove yourself from the sacrifice that the Egyptian culture would bring, which is a primitive sacrifice, which is based purely on the satisfaction of your idolatrous emotions. But you don't have to give up the whole institution. You don't have to give up the whole institution. You can have the institution, provided that you subject yourself to a system of mitzvot. And mitzvot's commandments entails control over that emotion. You have to discipline your emotion. You have to control it. And you can only satisfy it not by the way your emotion wants to, but through the system of mitzvot, which is abstract concepts, abstract ideas, many rules and regulations. But these rules and regulations are based upon ideas, and they require, in order to perform this mitzvah, you've got to be involved in thinking and study, and that takes you away from the primitive world of emotion, of the emotional. That's, I believe, what Rashi is getting at. That's why, for example, only in Egypt did it have to be set aside on the 10th. And the setting aside on the 10th was not for practical reasons, but was to establish that this animal that you're going to bring to God is of a different character. What is the idea of setting aside on the 10th? That you've got to examine it for blemish, to see that it doesn't have a blemish. Well, what exactly is a blemish? There are whole tractates in the Talmud on this.
Rabbi,
yeah, I'm sorry.
We have one question
based
on some of the conclusions you've just been bringing. If all forms of pagan religions used animal sacrifices, then why did Moshe institute a parallel system to them?
I'm saying that's Maimonides. Maimonides gives the explanation in the Moreh Nevuchim, and that is to say that the emotion to sacrifice to God was very powerful, and therefore, in order to establish a religion, only God can decide to what extent the religion would succeed if the people were deprived of certain emotional outlets. That's a very powerful emotion. Now, if that is utilized properly, then it can elevate a person to the highest level. So that's the case. In other words, you see that the institution of sacrifice is very restricted. It can only be brought in the temple, in the Beis HaMikdash. People weren't just permitted to sacrifice any place they wanted to. And it was under the complete control of the Kohanim. Literally, it's translated priest, but it means the Kohanim. And they were people who were trained in the knowledge and the ideas. And therefore, when a person would go to the temple, to Jerusalem, it would be a learning experience. He'd have to subject himself to all the rules and all the regulations. So therefore, God did not see fit to uproot this, to take this away, because it's a powerful emotion, and if utilized properly, can help a person, can elevate him to the highest to the highest level. And that's what I'm trying to say. That's what the Torah does. The Torah works with man's basic emotions, and it transforms him. It transforms him from being an instinctual creature to a thinking creature. The same is true, even the most mundane activity, like eating, for example. Everybody has a need to eat, a desire to eat. But for us, eating becomes a halachic experience. Before you can sit down to eat, first of all, you have to decide if the food is kosher or not kosher. And this is not just a simple rule and regulation. You know, once you study these laws, very refined concepts. And then you're sitting down to a meal. Very often, if you may have had this experience, you go to a wedding or a bar mitzvah or something, and all kinds of discussions will ensue as to what blessing do you make first, what blessing do you make, what's the blessing over this particular food. And with people who really understand the Talmud, you see it's not just simple matters. There are tremendous ideas. So the Torah surrounds all of our physical activities and doesn't ask us to renounce, basically. The Torah does not ask us to renounce our physical enjoyments, but we have to be able to gratify it through a system of mitzvahs. Now, the difference is like this, that an idolater will never be satisfied. See, the way the mitzvah is structured, maybe this will help to answer the question. A person who is on the primitive level of idolatry, who's looking to satisfy his primitive emotions, will never be satisfied with the sacrifice that the Torah has to offer, because it doesn't cater to the emotion. For example, this whole idea of setting aside the animal on the 10th, and then for blemish, you have to search for blemish. Now, what exactly is a blemish? Oh, you have to study concepts, and if it could be even some type of a thought that a person has. It could be something which is not physical, and that could disqualify the animal. So right away, you're breaking any emotional attachment to the physical animal itself. You can't project any mystical powers onto the animal. It's not a mystical experience. It can't satisfy him in a mystical way. But the essence of the sacrifice is a conceptual kind of thing. It just represents ideas. And when a person gets into it, he's getting away more and more from that mystical world where he's investing objects with powers, and they're satisfying his insecurities and his needs. And more he begins to see that these are all representative of abstract ideas. And that's the way the person, I guess that's the idea, the dream of Jacob, the ladder, that a person a person isn't born on that high level where he can relate to God, you know, through the intellectual. He needs a system in which he moves step by step up the ladder. And that is the system of mitzvos. The system of mitzvos addresses itself to the person on the lowest level with the primitive emotions. But if he follows that system, so more and more he's removing his energy from the primitive, and he can only gratify it through an intellectual performance. As I showed you in prayer, a person reads the prayers, they're not geared towards gratifying his personal emotional desires. It's through an objective text. With objective, you can study. You can make a whole study of the prayer itself. It's crammed with ideas and the expressions. What do they imply? What do they mean? So he's involved in a world of ideas, and he's getting away from that personal. Let me just see if I'd like to finish my points before I run out of time, then I'll be glad to take questions. This is the idea of the Passover in Egypt. That is to say, it was the night in which the Jewish people emerged and separated themselves from the Egyptian people, but separated themselves in a spiritual way. They differentiated themselves. And I believe that's why the holiday is called Pesach, Passover, which Rashi says refers to the skipping over. I skipped over the houses of the Jews. The Jews were living together. Physically, they were living together with the Egyptians. But God skipped over the house of the Jew and smote the Egyptian. What does it mean? And when Rashi says, what does it mean? I will see the blood. It means I saw that you're different. You differentiated yourself. And you were involved in acts of mitzvah. That is a totally different way of relating to God. You gave up the notion that you could follow your own primitive emotions and to worship the God of your imagination, and you subscribed to a system of mitzvahs, of ideas. And that's the essence of that night. It was a night of, that's why the holiday is Passover, which means God recognized the emergence of a separate people who were relating to a system of mitzvahs. I would like to try and explain. I didn't answer this question. If you remember way back at the beginning, we said that the difference between the Passover in Egypt and the Passover of the generations is with regard to the performance. The substance of the animal was the same. You know, it had to be prepared, roasted, and so forth. But verse 11 now, back to chapter 12, verse 11. In Egypt, thus shall you eat it. With your loins girded, your shoes on your feet, and your staffs in your hands, and you shall eat it in a hurried fashion. It is a Passover to the Lord. Now, the question is, why were they required to eat it in that particular fashion? Now, I think it fits in with everything we've been saying. Because the Jews were given a mitzvah to perform, and this, of course, was a sacrifice. Now, the Egyptians also sacrificed, but the idea of a sacrifice for an Egyptian was totally different than the sacrifice of a mitzvah. The sacrifice of a mitzvah was a completely different thing, as we saw. They couldn't get attached to the physical animal itself, believing that it had any properties. If you discover a blemish, you get a different animal. It's no good. It's disqualified. So there's nothing in the physical animal per se. It's rather an entity which represents certain ideas. Fine. But in order for them to bring this sacrifice, they had to separate themselves from the culture of Egypt and to recognize how harmful and destructive it was. Now, I believe that that's the requirement over here. In other words, you could not partake of this sacrifice if you still identify yourself as an Egyptian. You had to do an act which demonstrated that you were no longer a part of Egypt. Now, physically speaking, they had to be there the entire night. They weren't going to leave until the morning. But there's a difference between a person can be physically, as you know, very often, a person can be physically in one place, but mentally he's somewhere else. And I believe that that's what's being referred to over here. For example, let's say an individual, a person has been in jail for many, many years. He has a lifetime sentence or whatever. And finally, through some kind of, some kind of good fortune, he gets some kind of commutation of a sentence. So he's counting off the days until he's going to be free. He can't wait to get out of there. It's the worst prison in the world. He can't wait to get out of there.
Rabbi, we got 1 minute.
1 minute.
Yes,
okay.
Sir.
Then the day of freedom finally comes. Now he's going to be up very, very early, and he's going to have his bags. He has one little suitcase. His bags are packed. He's ready for the road. And even though he has a few hours to go, he's not going to be released until 12. 6 o'clock in the morning, he's dressed for the road. All of his thoughts are on the future. He's completely broken his tie. In other words, it's like we say, I'm out of here. He's no longer a part of that prison. See, that's in that framework, mentally he's on the road already. Physically, he's still going to be in the jail until 12 o'clock. But mentally, this guy is not. He's broken away from the prison. See, Egypt was a prison in terms of a true way of living. It was a spiritual prison. And before the Jews were permitted to partake of the Passover sacrifice, which was liberation, they had to make that break. And therefore, they had to be like people who had broken, who had recognized that this is the way of destruction and had separated themselves. The Rashi says they were prepared for the road, that spiritually they were no longer a part of Egypt. And that was only applicable in the Passover of Egypt, but not in the Passover generation. Okay, I believe that that was more than a minute.